Thank you very much. I won't be offended if you fall asleep tonight, because I'm going to speak about dreams, so feel free to dream, but then you'll have to share your dreams with me, and we'll interpret them together. No way. So yeah, we are going to talk about dreams and dream interpretation in the Bible. And of course, I'm sure you'll be disappointed because it's very different from dream interpretations by Sigmund Freud or by Jung or by any other psychologist, because these guys believe, of course, that dreams are a window into our inner life, while in the Bible, dreams are just messages from God. Most of the dreams in the Bible are messages from God, actually foretelling the future. God is actually, through the dreams, let us know what's going to happen to us in the future. And looking at the different dreams, and you have the handouts, I see you have blue handouts, beautiful color. So, you'll see that actually we have different types of dreams in the Bible. The first one that I actually quoted for you here on the handout is from Genesis chapter 20. Genesis 20, for those of you who have not identified the story yet, it's about Abraham and his wife Sarah being down there in the court of the Philistine king Abimelech. Abimelech is taking Sarah because he believes that she is just the sister of Abraham. He doesn't know she's his wife. And God has to interfere in order to save Sarah. And if you read this dream, you'll be really disappointed because it's just a phone message from God. You don't even see anything in this dream. You just hear God's voice telling Abimelech, well, be careful, that's what he says there. And God said to him in a dream, I knew that you did not, that you did this, meaning taking Sarah with a blameless heart, and so I kept you from sinning against me. That was, I did not let you touch her. Therefore, restore the man's wife, since he is a prophet, he'll intercede for you. By the way, that's a great definition of what a prophet is. That's the first time the term prophet is mentioned in the Bible here in Genesis 20. Abraham is being referred to as a prophet. And what does a prophet do? Prays for the person, for the sinner. We are used to think that, you know, the prophet is God's representative on earth. But actually, prophets are double agents. They are God's representatives, but they are also our defense lawyers. And so they pray for us, and then God listens and forgives, etc. Okay, but anyway, you see that this dream is, you don't see a picture, you don't see anything there. So that's one type. A different type, and that's number two on the handout. I just quoted one verse from it. It's from, you remember that in the Joseph story, the Joseph story, which is one of the longest stories in the Bible, it runs from Genesis 37 to Genesis 50. It's almost a short novel. Here in this story, you have three series of dreams. First of all, you have Joseph's own dreams in chapter 37. Then you have the dreams of the courtiers of Pharaoh who dream while they are in prison. And then you have Pharaoh's own dreams. So you have always couples of dreams. And we'll have a chance to look into some of them. But here what's interesting is what actually Joseph is saying to Pharaoh about Pharaoh's dreams. Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told Pharaoh what he is about to do. So you see, the way Joseph interprets the dreams of Pharaoh, this is a message from God. God is telling us what the future is going to be like. That's the whole idea of the dream. But the interesting part is, of course, that these dreams come in pairs. So if you remember, one of Pharaoh's dreams is about seven good fat cows, seven thin cows, and the other one is about seven fat ears of grain, and the other one about seven thin ones. But again, this dream, and the reason they hear, that's what Joseph is actually saying, that Pharaoh's dreams are one, it's like a control mechanism. Because, well, one dream may be just a coincidence. Who knows? Should we take it seriously or not? But at the moment, we have a second one to follow, and the second one conveys the same message, then we are certain that that's the message, and it's a message from God. And so now you see that every person can dream, of course. Even I dream. I won't share my dreams with you. I have wild dreams, but I'll keep them to myself. But anyway, every person can dream. But there are also professional dreamers. Can you imagine people who are paid just for dreaming? So you have this under number three. You see that dreaming or dreamers is one type of prophecy. And that's what the law in Deuteronomy tells us, that if there appears among you a prophet or a dream diviner or in cholem chalom, a person who dreams dreams. Yeah, cholem chalom. Excuse me?
I thought you said shalom.
Chalom. Chalom is a dream. Also, shalom is a dream. Unfortunately. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. But some dreams come true, you know. Anyway. So, if there appears among you a prophet or a dream diviner, and he gives you a sign or a portent saying, let us follow and worship another god whom you have not experienced, even if the sign or portent that he named to you comes true, do not heed the words of that prophet or that dream diviner. For the Lord your God is testing you. Meaning we should always trust these dream diviners, unless they cross one red line. If they tell you to worship another god, then of course we should not follow them. We should not trust their dreams. And of course, if you continue reading this paragraph, I won't read the whole thing. As for that prophet or dream diviner, he shall be put to death. That's what we used to do in the Middle East. Yeah, put to death. It's fine. Anyway, so another example of where we learn about the relationship between dreams and prophecy is the story number four, is the story in the book of Numbers, chapter 12, about Miriam and Aaron complaining that Moses, you know, claims for a monopoly on prophecy. And they are trained prophets too. And they don't like it that Moses feels himself superior to them. So they complain. And then God answers them and tells them that, well, there is a difference between Moses' prophecy and their prophecy. There are different types of prophets. By the way, if you look at the Bible, you see that we have this term prophet, but there are so many different types of prophecy, hardly related to one another. Really, what if you take a prophet like Jeremiah or like Isaiah on the one hand, and a prophet like Elisha or even Elijah who perform miracles? But yeah, the type of prophecy is so very different. And then you have prophets that, you know, like rock bands. They play music, and the moment they play music, they get into ecstasy, and then they get naked, and then they start prophesying. I don't know what drugs they were taking. Unfortunately, they didn't leave the prescription in the Bible. But so you see, we have so many different types of prophets. So God is telling actually Miriam and Aaron that Moses is very different. While to the other prophets, like Moses and Miriam, second-rate prophets, he speaks through dreams. With Moses, he speaks face to face. Moses really sees God and talks to him. So that's what he says. With him I speak mouth to mouth, plainly and not in riddles. And he beholds the likeness of the Lord. How then did you dare shrink from speaking against my servant Moses? So what's important is that he says about the other prophets, like Moses and Miriam, that actually to them he speaks in riddles. Dreams are riddles. And that's something to remember and to understand, that dreams are like riddles. You see a dream, it's like solving a riddle. If you want to interpret the dream, it's like solving a riddle. Because, you know, you see a picture, and the question is, what are you going to do with this picture? How are you going to interpret it? And good riddles have more than one solution to them. When I deal with other types of riddles in the Bible, for instance, another lecture that I'll give this month a couple of times, I believe, is about the Song of Songs. And in love poetry, great love poetry, I love it. Anyway, so in the Song of Songs, you have these love poems. Many of them, if not all of them, are riddles. And you read them, the first time you read them, you think you have understood everything. Then you read them again, you say to yourself, oy vey, I haven't... actually, the message is very different from what I have thought the first time I read them. So good riddles have more than one solution, and so do the different dreams. And that's why, you know, there's always a difference between normative religion and folk religion. Because in normative religion, of course... According to normative religion, of course, the dream is God's message. The prophet, if he's a good one, can interpret the message, but nothing more than that. According to folk religion, the prophet is the one to make reality by the way he interprets the dream. Like another folk belief, very common in the Bible, that a person with his own blessing or with his own curse can create reality. If you remember, for instance, the story about Isaac in the book of Genesis, chapter 27, he wants to bless his son Esau because Esau feeds him with good steaks. So he wants to bless him. And then Rebekah, of course, wants her other son, Jacob, to sneak in to be blessed by Isaac. Why is it so important? Because Rebekah believes, and so does Jacob, that actually Isaac, with his own blessing, you know, can create reality, can change the future, can change history, future history. Or the same thing, if you remember the story about the prophet Balaam, in the book of Numbers, chapter 22, the king of Moab, Balak, wants to hire Bilam, the prophet, to curse Israel because he believes that he is the best curser in the Middle East. But Bilam himself is very sincere and tells Balak, well, I cannot bless anybody whom God doesn't want to bless. I cannot curse anybody whom God doesn't want to curse. So again, you see here the conflict between normative religion and folk religion. And it's true also for prophecy and dream and dream interpretation. Talking about prophecy, there is this beautiful story in 1 Kings chapter 22 about King Ahab going to war against the Arameans, and he goes to war together. They have a coalition, like the coalition you have now in Iraq. I shouldn't have mentioned it. Today is a great day for America. Your president has been inaugurated again. Mazel tov. But we are talking now about 1 Kings chapter 22, right? So in this story, the king of Israel and the king of Judah are going together fighting against the Arameans. And the king of Judah wants to hear what a prophet has to say about it, about their chances. So the king of Israel brings like 400 prophets, actually a choir, a huge choir, and they all sing the same song, go for it, go for it, God, yeah, of course. And King Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, he already knows the American idea of second opinion. He wants to hear a second opinion. So don't you have around another prophet here? He said, yeah, there is another prophet here, Michaihu, son of Imla, but he hates me. He always come up with bad prophecies. Meaning, again, you see that the king believes that the prophet actually creates reality with what he says. He doesn't just bring us the news from God, but creates his own reality by his own words. And that's why people are very careful when it comes to interpretation of dreams. They believe that the interpreters are creating reality. But now let's read together, and that's going to be the most complicated part of this lecture. We are going to read number 5 on the handout, the story that you know very well, and that's the story that of the covenant between the pieces, Brit Bein HaBetarim, in Genesis chapter 15. First of all, we start with setting up the stage. You see that we are told that he, meaning the big he, says to Abraham, Abraham asks an intelligent question, how do I know that you are really going to give me that this country? And God tells him now to work a little. Bring me a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old she-goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young bird. Just imagine Abraham running after all these animals to collect them. But by the way, it's funny because the funny part is, okay, for kids who speak Hebrew, of course, and in Hebrew, a three-year-old, in the Bible, it's meshulash. But meshulash is a triangle also in Hebrew. So Israeli kids think about a triangle, a heifer, a triangle, a she-goat, etc., etc. They don't quite understand that we are talking here about a three-year-old heifer, etc., etc. By the way, when we read...
Heifer.
Thank you very much. Heifer. Okay, heifer. I'll remember. Good. Now, before we actually continue reading this story, I want you to remember that here in this prophecy, in this dream, we have already a different element, and this element is it's an audiovisual show. Because, for instance, in the dreams of Pharaoh or the dreams of Joseph that we are going to discuss later, or the dreams of the two courtiers of Pharaoh, the dreams are like silent movies. But in this movie, the sound system is already embedded into the movie. And there is and the interesting part is actually looking for correlation between the sound element and the visual element of the movie. We should see if there is any correlation there. Which reminds me that many, many years ago, when I was still a boy, they haven't discovered yet the way in Israel to embed the, to bring the subtitles into the movie. And of course we needed subtitles, who knew English? So they used to roll the translation, the English translation, on a separate roll on the side. There was a different person sitting there rolling the translation. Sometimes he was too quick, and so we knew who the murderer was before the detective on the movie knew who the murderer was. And sometimes he was too slow, and people used to scream, "Hey, did you fall asleep? What's going on?" So it was quite funny. But here we'll see if there is any correlation between the two systems, the sound and the visual one. So, yeah, so God is telling Abraham to bring all these animals. And what does he do? He brought him all these and cut them in two, placing each half opposite to the other. But he did not cut the bird. You see now what the stage looks like now. He did cut three animals, the heifer, and the other one. But he did not cut the birds. So what's the idea here? What is the idea of cutting the three animals and not cutting the two birds? We'll see later. We'll have to find out. So, and then we hear that birds of prey came down upon the carcasses and Abraham drove them away. So it's a bad omen when these birds of prey come down on, but Abraham drives them away, which is a good sign. Yeah, so what... We don't still yet understand what's going to happen here. Fine, let's continue reading and we'll see. So as the sun was about to set, a deep sleep fell upon Abraham, and a great dark dread descended upon him. And he said to Abraham, he's still not called Abraham, he's still called Avram and not Avraham. Yeah, anyway. So know well that your offspring shall be strangers in a land not theirs, and they shall be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will execute judgment on the nation they shall serve, and in the end they shall go free with great wealth. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at the ripe old age, and they, meaning the Israelites, shall return here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Meaning they will be enslaved for three generations and come back on the fourth. Now you see the difference between the three generations of enslavement. These are the animals we cut, and the birds, the symbol of freedom, we didn't cut, and that's the fourth generation that is going to get free and to return to the land. But the show is not over yet. Actually, by the way, there is one sentence here that I like so very much. We are being told here, in what I've already read, that the Israelites shall be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years, but I will execute judgment on the nation they shall serve, and in the end they shall go free. And why can't they get the land yet? For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Meaning the land is still the land of the Amorites, and we cannot get into the country because the Amorites have not sinned enough yet. You know, a drop after drop after drop. Oh, I have a glass. So a drop, we add more drop, another sin, and when the cup gets full, then of course it's a sign that they have sinned enough. Now I, God, am allowed to take the land from them and to give it to you, Israelites. And if we understand the message, we Israelites will understand that God may do the same thing to us, which of course happened to us. Why do we find ourselves at the end of the book of Kings in exile? Because we didn't understand the message there, and we didn't understand that God will treat us the very same way. He'll count our sins, and the moment the glass is full, he'll take the land from us too. And he did it. What can I do? Anyway, so now, why three generations of slavery, three cut animals, and fourth generation that goes free? Why do we have this pattern of three and four? Let's see what happens in under number six, which is the law of the Hebrew slave according to the book of Deuteronomy. You know that we have three different laws of Hebrew slave in the Torah, one in Exodus 21, one in Deuteronomy 15, one in Leviticus 25. But here we are referring to the one in Deuteronomy 15, verse 18. And the lawgiver is actually telling the Israelites, when you do set him free, meaning when you let your slave go free after 6 years of slavery, do not feel aggrieved, for in the 6 years he has given you double the service of a hired man. Moreover, the Lord your God will bless you in all you do. Meaning, now it's time for a math class. If you hear here that he says that in his 6 years of slavery, he has given you double the service of a hired man, it means that a hired man, whatever it means being a hired man serves for 3 years. And since he served you double the time for 6 years, don't feel aggrieved for letting him go free. You had a great deal. He served you twice the time that a hired person or a hired man served. Well, the same concept of a hired man serving 3 years is found also, number seven, in the book of Isaiah. That is the word from the Lord that the Lord spoke concerning Moab long ago. And now the Lord has spoken, in 3 years, fixed like the years of a hired man, Moab's population with all its huge multitude shall shrink. Only a remnant shall be left of no consequence. Again, you see the same concept. 3 years is the term, is the time that a hired man serves. Now we know, actually, also from the book of Job, for instance, chapter 7, that a hired man is some type of slavery. It was a well-known type of slavery. A slave used to serve 3 years and went free on the fourth. And by the way, I'm sure that all of you know by heart the Code of Hammurabi, the Babylonian law code. But anyway, when you go home, check me if I'm right. But in paragraph number 117, say 117, in the Code of Hammurabi, it's a paragraph concerning a slave. And a slave, according to Hammurabi, serves indeed 3 years. and goes free on the fourth. So that was a common concept in the ancient Near East. Now, but in our Bible, we have, you know, in all laws about the Hebrew slave, being it Exodus 21 or Deuteronomy 15, a slave serves for 6 years, because we wanted all the whole system to go by the pattern of 6 and 7. 6 days of work, Shabbat the seventh day. 6 years of cultivating the land, and the sabbatical year, the seventh year, and then. So that's why also we changed it. So the Hebrew slave serves for 6 years and goes free only on the seventh. But here you see that still the book of Deuteronomy, and of course Isaiah, are still aware of the older concept that a slave served for 3 years and went free on the fourth. And this tradition is actually behind the story we have just read. Because an individual serves for 3 years and goes free on the fourth. But the nation was enslaved for 3 generations and went free on the fourth generation. Fine. But now it's not over yet. I should have copied one more verse from Genesis 15. I got tired. I can always blame the secretary, which I always do. But the verse that I should have actually copied, verse 17, when the sun set and it was very dark, there appeared a smoking oven. That's the kind of ovens you had in the 20s, I guess. Smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between the pieces. So the show is not over yet. Now it's very dark. Abraham is still dreaming and he sees a smoking oven and the flaming torch passing between these pieces. What it is all about? And something else that you should know, that here we are talking about pieces, but in the Hebrew story, we start talking about pieces using one term, betarim, brit bein betarim, the covenant between the pieces. So the pieces are referred to as betarim. But all of a sudden, in the verse that I've just read now, it's not betarim anymore, but gezarim. Has nothing to do with carrots, by the way. Gezer in Hebrew is carrot, nothing to do with that. But anyway, so all of a sudden, the terminology has been changed. Now, if you read under number 9, Psalm 136, verses 13 and 14, it's a psalm about praising God for the great deeds he did for us in history, who split apart the sea into pieces. Actually, these words are missing, into pieces. Who split apart the sea of reeds into pieces. His steadfast love is eternal and made Israel pass through it. His steadfast love is eternal. Meaning, God split apart the sea of reeds into pieces, and the term we have here in Psalm 136 is Gezarim, and this psalm is about the Exodus, is about the great miracle of the Exodus, that the Sea of Reeds has split and the Israelites passed through it. So this is the picture you have here now. It's actually foretelling Abraham about the future. You know, the sea will split and everybody will pass through it. Fine. Now, why a smoking oven and why a smoking oven and a flaming torch? If you get back to text number 8, it's the story of the Exodus. The pillar of cloud went before the Israelites by day, and the pillar of fire by night, and they did not depart from before the people. Meaning, there was this pillar of fire, like pillar of cloud, like smoke, and pillar of fire. That's how God led Israel in the wilderness and through the Sea of Reeds. And this is now the smoking oven and the flaming torch. So only when you actually get to the book of Exodus, or even to the book of Psalms, you are actually able to solve all the elements of this riddle. Okay, fine. Now we can move on to dreams. Now we are moving on to the dreams of Joseph. The two dreams of Joseph. Yeah, when he's still a young man and pretty stupid. Meaning, yeah, when he's young, he's still stupid, so very proud of himself. You know, he can't shut his mouth. Because you see these dreams in which your brothers are bowing down to you. Shut up, don't tell them. Don't. Do you think that they'll be happy to hear it? They'll clap for you, they'll be happy to hear about it? Of course not. But he's still young and naive and doesn't really think. But the great thing about Joseph, and that's why we are so lucky to have such a long story about Joseph. As I told you, it's one of the longest stories in the Bible, because slowly, slowly he gets mature, he changes. When later on he's already in Egypt and his brothers come to Egypt, oh, he knows how to be quiet. Now it's time for him to test them to see if they have changed. He doesn't reveal his identity so quickly. He tortures them pretty nicely. Yeah, so he's getting better and better. But
Joseph.
Yeah. Yeah, in Broadway. Yeah. Same Joseph. Yosel, Yosel. Yeah. So anyway, let's read about the two dreams of Joseph. So once Joseph had a dream, which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field when suddenly my sheaf stood up and remained upright. Then your sheaves gathered around and bowed low to my sheaf." His brothers answered, "Do you mean to reign over us? Do you mean to rule over us?" And they hated him even more for his talk about his dreams. Fine. But, obviously, I would have hated him too. But you see, here you have their interpretation of the dream. They immediately are, of course, they are interested only in one element of the dream, the fact that they are bowing down to him, but one element is ignored by them. Why do they see sheaves and not, for instance, elephants? There is a reason for it. Of course, we'll understand why we talk about sheaves when they will come to Egypt hungry, and of course Joseph will supply them with grain. That's why we are talking about sheaves. But they still don't understand it. They totally ignore this element. Of course, they care only about one thing, about them bowing down to him. Fine, and then he dreams another dream, and again he runs immediately to tell his brothers about it. So number 11, he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers, saying, "Look, I have had another dream." What a dummy. "And this time the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." Look, one may think, of course, that this guy has a serious problem. His superiority complex gets more and more serious. In the first dream, it was just sheaves that were bowing down to him. Mele, fine. But this time, it's the whole universe bowing down to him. The sun and the moon and the 11 stars. So, of course, his brother is not very happy. And when he told it to his father and brothers, this time he's even including his father, his father berated him. What he said to him, "Is this dream you have dreamed? Are we to come, I and your mother?" By the way, the mother is already dead for a long time, because Joseph's mother is Rachel, who died when years and years ago, at least 20 years earlier. "And your brothers and bow low to you to the ground?" So his brothers were wrought up at him, and his father kept the matter in mind. Meaning the father at least understands that there is some message here, some divine message, that something is going to happen in the future that will reveal the nature of this dream. But of course the brothers don't understand. But here you have the interpretation of the father. The father immediately understands that speaking about the sun, the moon, and 11 stars. Of course, the moment he sees the number 11 And, of course, he has 12 sons, Jacob. He understands that that's a dream about him, Rachel, and the children going down to Joseph. But now, why do we bother to bring Rachel back from the dead for this dream? And we already know that numbers have always a meaning in these dreams. We'll see it also when we move on to the dreams of the two courtiers of Pharaoh. So numbers play a role. Now, how many objects are actually bowing down to Joseph in this dream? Father, mother, and 11 sons. 13. You are very quick in math. You're much better than I am, I'm telling you. So what's the meaning of the number 13? Okay, I know that in some hotels there is no 13th floor, it's not a lucky number. I don't know. I was at Bar Mitzvah when I was 13. It was pretty good. Anyway.
13 months of leap.
Well, let's see what happens here. How old was Joseph when he was introduced to us in Genesis 37? When he is introduced to us, he's 17 years old. But then in Genesis chapter 41, verse 46, we hear that he is 30 years old when he faces Pharaoh. When he faces Pharaoh with a great solution for the famine in the land in Egypt, he is 30 years old. 13 years have passed. After 13 years, that's the time to reveal the truth, that's the time to when we actually can solve this riddle, this dream of Joseph. So the number is significant here. Fine. Now something else. Of course, under number 12, on your handout, when the brothers come again to Egypt, we hear that now Joseph was the vizier of the land. It was he who dispensed rations to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed low to him with their faces to the ground. So, of course, now we see that the dream has come true, and they do bow down to him. And now we see also that they came to Egypt because they were hungry, because of the famine in the land. So we understand the importance of the sheaves we saw in the first dream. We still don't quite understand what the importance of the sun and the moon in the second dream. Why the sun and the moon? Of course, we know that Joseph, indeed, it was not a superiority complex. He was superior. Yeah, and that's what psychologists say to some people. It's not an inferiority complex you suffer from. You're inferior. under number 13 we read, so it was not you, when the brothers come to at the end of the Joseph story or towards the end, Joseph is telling his brothers, so it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of all his household, and ruler over the whole land of Egypt. Meaning, I am superior. I have been made superior. I have become a father to Pharaoh. I am almost a master of this universe. You know, like Egypt is the empire of its times. It's again like being like a father to Pharaoh. It's almost like being Condi or something like that, if we still think about the great events of the last couple of days. Yeah. So anyway. Uh-huh. Anyway, but that's not, I told you about 20 minutes ago, that good riddles have more than one solution. And when we keep reading, now we move on to number 14. Number 14 is a quotation from the blessing of Moses. If you remember Deuteronomy 33, right before Moses dies, he blesses all the tribes of Israel. And when he blesses Joseph, the tribe of Joseph. Actually, Joseph is the father of two tribes, of Ephraim and Manasseh. But here in the blessing, Moses is referring to Joseph as a tribe, as one of the tribes. And what does he say to Joseph? And of Joseph he said, "Blessed of the Lord be his land, with the bounty of dew from heaven and of the deep that couches below, with a bounteous yield of the sun and the bounteous crop of the moons." Meaning, they have believed. Well, it's not the way I understand this universe, but at least they have believed that the quality of the crops is related to the blessing of the moon, or that the moon and the sun are playing a major role in creating good crops. So that's why the moon and the sun are mentioned here. And now it's the blessing to the tribe of Joseph. And now if we understand that Joseph saw this dream related to the famine in the land, related to the food supply that he could help his brothers with, and in that dream he saw the moon and the sun, now we understand that the moon and the sun have something to do with food, has something to do with crops. It was not a coincidence that he saw the moon and the sun. Something else. And you know that one of the famous Josephites, or one of the most famous descendants of Joseph, is Joshua, son of Nun. Joshua is an Ephraimite, meaning from the tribe of Ephraim, Ephraim who was the son of Joseph. And what's the most famous story about Joshua? Joshua stops the sun and the moon. Joshua holds the sun and the moon, and that's in Joshua chapter 10, verses 13 and 14. And we hear that the sun stood still and the moon halted while the nation wreaked judgment on its foes, etc., etc. Joshua is the one who said, "Stand still, O sun, in Gibeon, and the moon in the valley of Ayalon." Joshua is the one who stopped, who had the power to command the sun and the moon. So no wonder that we have such a blessing to Joseph in the book of Genesis. That's foretelling us not what's going to happen in the days of Joshua himself, but what's going to happen in the lifetime of one of his descendants, Joshua, son of Nun. By the way, there are many resemblances between traditions about Joseph and traditions about Joshua. For instance, only these two guys have lived 110 years, not 120. 120, it's Moses, but 110 is Joseph in the book of Genesis and Joshua in the book of Joshua. Joshua for the people of Israel was in many ways not just a second Moses, but also like a second Joseph. Okay, we finish with this series of dreams. We can move on to the next series. And the next series is the dream, the two dreams of the courtiers of Pharaoh. And in Genesis number 16 on your handout, so the two courtiers being in prison with Joseph, you know that Joseph was put in prison after the wife of Potiphar, his master, blamed him of tempting her. And of course, the poor innocent guy was put in jail. But he was lucky. God was with him even when he was in jail. And God was the one to help him to interpret the dreams of the two courtiers, which helped him later, since he had already his claim to fame as one who could interpret dreams. That's why when Pharaoh had his dreams, the courtier all of a sudden remembered Joseph and recommended him to the king. And that's why Joseph's career has actually started. Fine. So now we get back to the dreams of these two courtiers. Both of them, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed in the same night, each his own dream, and each
dream.
With its own, it says a typo there, and each dream with its own meaning. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were distraught. So before I continue, when we read the two dreams of Joseph, it's like, you know, that in biblical poetry we have the phenomenon of synonymous parallelism, meaning the second half of the verse tells you exactly what the first half told you, but using different words. That's synonymous parallelism. And even if we think about the two dreams of Pharaoh, which we are not going to dream, seven cows, seven ears of grain, again, it's like synonymous parallelism, because the second dream is telling you exactly what the first dream told you. So when we get to the two dreams of the two courtiers, after reading already about the two dreams of Joseph, we are ready actually to see the same phenomenon here, as if we are going to see here another synonymous parallelism. Are we going to see a case of synonymous parallelism here? No, but that's going to be a surprise. So, and Joseph came to them in the morning. He saw that they were distraught. He asked Pharaoh's courtiers who were with him in custody in his master's house, saying, "Why do you appear downcast today?" And they said to him, "We had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." So Joseph said to them, "Surely God can interpret. Tell me your dreams." Meaning, he's not telling them, "I'm God," but he's telling them, "God is will help me to interpret your dreams." Yeah, so now, by the way, Joseph is for us a dreamer and the one who also interprets dreams. Yeah, he has both capacities. Joseph, you know, in later Jewish tradition, Joseph is referred to as Yosef Baal HaChalomot, Joseph the dreamer. That becomes, he has like two claims to fame. He's Yosef der Tzadik in later Jewish literature, and also Yosef Baal HaChalomot, Joseph the dreamer. And that's important, Joseph the dreamer. And I mention it because there is a second Joseph the dreamer. Who is Joseph the dreamer number two? That's not in our Bible, but that's in the New Testament. In the New Testament, in Matthew, at the very beginning, Joseph, the husband of Mary, has one role only, to dream. And he has four dreams. The first dream he has, when the angel appears to him and tells him, "Well, your wife is going to have a son, the Holy Spirit, etc., etc." You know, I don't have it to tell you the story. Fine. Then, dream number two, when he is told by the angel in his dream that it's dangerous and they have to go down to Egypt. Now, dream number three, it's time to come back from Egypt, to go back to Bethlehem. Dream number four, it's still dangerous in Bethlehem, go up to the Galilee. And then he does not appear. You won't hear anything about Joseph. That's it. He finished his job. He finished dreaming. We don't need him anymore. And the most interesting part is that at the very beginning of the New Testament, the very beginning of Matthew chapter 1, you have a genealogy of Jesus, a family line of Jesus. And what's the name of Joseph's father in this genealogy? Jacob. Jacob, so he has to be Joseph, son of Jacob, dreamer number two. Because look, when they wrote these books, the Gospels of the New Testament, they wanted these books to appeal to Jews. So they wanted the stories to be familiar, the characters to be familiar. So naturally, they actually told us about Joseph II. Okay, anyway. Yeah, but let's see what happens with the dreams of the courtiers. So, So, what number am I on? 17. 17. Yes. So now we have the dreams themselves. Yeah. Then the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph. He said to him, "In my dream, there was a vine in front of me. On the vine were three branches. It had barely budded, when out came its blossom and its clusters ripened into grapes." Such a beautiful, optimistic picture. Growth, blossom, and it happens miraculously so quickly. You know, one moment it had barely budded, and the next moment it's already came in its blossoms and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup, he continues, Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grape. I pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. You see, also, some very important element is how, first of all, how active this guy is. I did that, and I did that, and I did that. He is very active. And the most important part is that Pharaoh is there in the dream, and he is serving Pharaoh, meaning he is doing what he used to do before Pharaoh got upset or angry with him. And that's why Joseph now is interpreting the dream for him. This is its interpretation. The three branches, and we already know that numbers are very important and are always being interpreted as units of time. So the three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will pardon you. Bad translation. The meaning is will pardon you. But it's very, later on you'll understand why it's so very important. What we are actually being told here, Pharaoh will lift your face. Will lift your head, actually. Will lift your head. Literally, Yisa et Roshcha will lift your head. What's the? By the way, it's a legal term. When a person is found innocent in court, then the judge lifts the person's head, meaning the person doesn't have to feel, you know, guilty anymore. His face can be lifted. He is free to go. So Pharaoh will lift your head. That's what he's being told. Later on, we'll understand why it's important. So Pharaoh will lift your head and restore you to your post. You will place Pharaoh's cup in his hand, as was your custom formerly when you were his cup bearer. Fine. Now, see what happens with the other guy. The other guy is very scared, you know. His dream hasn't been interpreted yet. But on the other hand, he's now encouraged when he realizes that Joseph solved the first riddle so nicely, so favorably. He hopes for a good interpretation too. Again, you can see here that in a way he believes that Joseph is actually creating reality and not just interpreting a dream. So when the chief baker saw how favorably he had interpreted, he said to Joseph, "In my dream, similarly..." You see, he wants a similar interpretation, so he says, "In my dream, similarly." He wants to influence Joseph. He actually, the way he tells the dream, he actually already plans the interpretation of the dream. So in my dream, similarly, there were 3 open work baskets. We'll deal with the open work baskets. The open work baskets, what are open work baskets? We'll deal with it later. On my head. Of course, he mentions the word head because he remembers that, you know, Joseph interpreted the dream of the other guy that his head was lifted. So he makes sure to mention the word head in his dream. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of food for Pharaoh that the baker prepares. What does a baker prepare? Bread, croissants, cookies, you know, you name it. The goodies, all these goodies. But of course, bread, that's what we are talking about, which is also a very important element. We'll get back to it later. And the birds were eating it out of the basket above my head. Again, mentioning the word head. Oy vey. On the one hand, we saw some resemblance between the two dreams. Here we had the number 3, here we had the number 3, here we have a head, here we have a head. But yet, if you are a sensitive enough reader or a sensitive enough interpreter of dreams, you realize immediately that what we see here is totally different. First of all, Pharaoh is not there. B, our guy, the chief baker, is not active this time. He is very passive. Things happen to him. He is not there to serve Pharaoh, to do anything, but things are happening to him. And these birds are coming. It's not Pharaoh who eats the bread. It's these birds who eat the bread. Meaning the food of Pharaoh is being eaten by somebody else. I don't think that Pharaoh is going to like it. And that's why Joseph is telling this guy, this is the interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. Well, so far so good. The baker can be so very happy. But not when he hears the next sentence. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head. A minor difference. Instead of Isa et Roshcha, lift your head, we lift your off your head. Isa et Roshcha mi alecha, meaning behead you. Yeah? Behead you and impale you upon a pole. And the birds will pick off your flesh. Oy vey. And now we read. Before we get to number 19, look at number 20 and 21 and 22. And because there are some elements in the dream of the second guy, of the chief baker, that we can actually understand only if we understand that there are some word plays here. You know, in dreams, in dream interpretation, word plays are very important. And that's something that Freud actually understood very well. But not only Freud, for instance, forget about dreams, but a very close phenomenon to dreams are visions. Visions that prophets have. And for instance, we have the vision that Amos sees. Amos sees in chapter 6, kluv kites, a basket of summer fruit. Kites is summer, right? Kites is summer. So he sees a very nice picture, you know, of a basket with summer fruit, with grapes, mangoes, apples, I don't know. Anyway, it's very nice. So, very optimistic picture, and yet the interpretation is, Heikitz haketz al ami Yisrael. That's the end of my people Israel. How come? Because the word ketz, the end, and the word kites, summer, sound alike. And actually, they have sounded more alike in the dialect of the northern kingdom. We know that the way they pronounce the word kites, summer, was actually ketz, the way they pronounced the word end. So you see one thing, but you understand the wordplay and you interpret it differently. Or for instance, we have a very similar thing, or vision in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah, again, chapter number 1, he sees makel shaked, a branch of almond. Again, a very nice picture. Like a Japanese fruit, flower. Yeah. But what God is telling him, Ki shoked ani al dvari la'asoto. I'm determined to do my shtick, meaning to finish with the people of Israel. Shoked, determined. Determined to go for it, to do it. So word plays are very important. And if we understand correctly, some words, or if we pay attention to some word plays in this interpretation, we are going to understand very well why Joseph interpreted the second dream so very differently from the way he interpreted the first dream. First of all, we referred here to some kinds of basket, 3 open work baskets. In Hebrew, salei chori. Chori, that's the word, chori, for this type of baskets. But chori means also something else. Under number 22, all nations will ask, why did the Lord do thus to the land? Wherefore that awful wrath? Wrath in Hebrew is chori, anger. anger. So when the baker sees Salei Chori, Joseph immediately hears in the Chori not just the open work basket, but also the anger of Pharaoh with this guy. And something else. Now, we said that the baker, all these goodies, are lechem, bread, right? Lechem. But lechem, lechem is bread. But if we, who knows Arabic? Lahem. Lahem in Arabic is meat. Is meat. Is flesh. Is flesh. You know, in Proto-Semitic, a language, if you take all the Semitic languages, you know, and you go back to an imagined language created by scholars, the Proto-Semitic language from which all the Semitic languages emerged, then the basic word for food was lechem. But for us Israelites, a nation of farmers, of course, lechem became bread. For the Arabs, a nation of nomads, of shepherds, of course, the basic food was meat. Yeah? So that's why for us bread is lechem, and for them lechem is meat. But there are also some verses in the Bible in which lechem is still meat. And not in, like here under number 21, you have a verse from the prophet Zephaniah. I'll bring distress on the people, and they shall walk like blind men, because they sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be spilled like dust, and it's not fat, and their flesh like dung. And the word for flesh, ulechumam, their lahem, their flesh. So when Joseph hears that the birds are eating the bread, he understands that there is a reference here to the flesh of the baker being eaten by the birds, not the bread prepared for Pharaoh, but his own flesh, which will be eaten by the birds. So again, always pay attention, A, to numbers, B, to word plays, to words that have more than one meaning. So you see how sensitive and clever was Joseph in interpreting these dreams. And what we have here with the dreams of the courtiers, it's not a synonymous parallelism, but what we call another phenomenon that we have in biblical poetry, antithetic parallelism, that the second half of the verb of the verse is the opposite of the first half of the verse. So you see that all these interpretations are, in all these interpretations of dreams, what we have is the interpreters are actually midrashizing. That, by the way, that's a word that I created, my contribution to the English dictionary. You know, it's mine. Check in the Webster dictionary. Do you see the YZ, Iazakovich name? Yeah. So, they are actually midrashizing the pictures. That's what they do. And actually, when we get to this type of interpretation, it's not that far from Freud's interpretation of dreams. But Freud was a good Jewish boy like Joseph, so no surprise. Thank you very much.